Okay, time to start again. I have to jump a little bit in the presentation now to give you some background or the necessary terminology that I ask about in the assignment that you will be given. Because I in that assignment, as you may have seen, I also ask about two other or two important terms, reliability and validity. Reliability has to do with the how consistent a measurement is. If we are dealing with a speedometer in a car, well, a reliable measurement of speed would be that any time a car drives at a given speed, the dial, the speedometer, gives the same reading. So every time you drive at a given speed, it always says 60. It's not so that it sometimes say 70 or sometimes say 50, even though the mean is 60. It's spot on all the time. That's reliability. Validity is the extent to which a concept or a conclusion or a measurement is correct, or does it correspond to the outside world? And that is different from the reliability, meaning that even though the speedometer may say 60 kilometers an hour every time you drive at a given speed, the actual speed may be 70. If you measure a length, well, if the measurement tool you're using there isn't correct, maybe the first 5 centimeters is gone or something like that, well, you would always measure something at a given length, but actually it would be 5 centimeters shorter. That's the correct thing if you try to put this into the real world. This is often shown in a table like this. You may have a very reliable instrument. Let's say you're shooting at a target here. A reliable shooter, well, he will always shoot at the same point. But it may be wrong, even though his spread here is very little. Something that's both reliable and valid, well, there he would also hit the target. And these are very important concepts, because even though you have a measurement or an instrument that actually measures something in a very good way, well, it doesn't necessarily give you valid results in the conclusion. Because there may be a bad relationship between these two, and we should always analyze both of these. You may have a very little, or you may have an unreliable instrument that's in general very unreliable, but which always are centering the correct target where the mean value would be correct. And that's something you can compensate for instance, by taking a huge number of measurements. What you can't compensate for is this situation where you have an unreliable instrument that also doesn't fit the real world, that misses the target as well. That's, of course, a very bad situation. We usually say that, well, if you're going to measure something, reliability is usually a prerequisite for doing valid conclusions. You need reliability to make valid conclusions. But it good reliability doesn't ensure that you get good conclusions. So it's a prerequisite, good reliability. I say this because, as I said, you will be given an assignment here now. Maybe I have this here somewhere. Should be somewhere here. That's the one. What you're going to do the next week is that you're going to write a short essay. And when I say short essay, I mean something maybe only 2 pages or maybe less. It's just to make sure that you have understood these some of the important terminologies that we are dealing with here. You're going to read 2 short papers. They should be available now on Infronter. You have seen it already. One is an article from a journal called the Journal of Improbable Research. It's a good source. It's a good place to go and see some interesting research. It's linked in the Fronter page, so you can go there. They give out some alternative Nobel Prizes and stuff like that for funny research. But typically research that is done in a methodological good way. The conclusions may be quite wrong now and then, as you will see. In the first article here, this Kansas is flatter than a pancake. Well, they have investigated this, a general saying. We have similar things, flatsmen pannekake, in Norwegian as well. And this is often said about the state of Kansas then. When you go there, it's just a huge flat thing. Very few mountains. But of course it's maybe difficult to measure, and what they've done here is that they've actually tried to do this. They've tried to measure whether Kansas is flatter than a pancake. And what you're going to do then is to identify both the independent and dependent variables that's involved there, and you are to look at how they have operationalized the variables. And I also want you to think about maybe where they came short in their operationalization. Where did they miss? And I want you to try to think a little bit about reliability and validity issues there. Did they have a reliable measurement? And was it correct? Or was it transferable to the real world? That is one of the articles. The other short paper that you're going to analyze, and you can do this in one short paper, maybe one page for each of these two papers. That has to do with, or treat them together if you like, that's okay. The other one is a short paper that I presented in a conference a couple of years ago. A short study that we did here is not necessarily very good. It was a quick thing we did and that we reported, where we looked at the effects of having computers in an auditorium like this. They wanted to see what people were doing and how other observers in the auditorium experienced others' use of computers. So it's not necessarily a very good paper. It's published as a paper in a peer-reviewed journal, so it was decently good. This presentation, or the short paper, was presented on a conference. I think I will spend a little time now going through the presentation we gave of that paper on the conference. I won't give the whole presentation, but what we'll just I'll give some of that presentation so that you get an idea what this paper is about. Maybe it will help you a little bit in identifying the variables involved as well. So what we call this study was then we wanted to see whether internet devices used in the classroom. We were that general when we talked about it. Although this was done a few years ago with fewer tablets and fewer phones with huge screens, stuff like that was available. So mostly we were looking at computers in the auditoriums. We know that students use computers, and they use computers for other means than just taking notes, right? Never. We think they do. Even though we are standing in front here and don't see it, we thought that would be the case. And of course, this is a debate in some. Well, when we as teachers are discussing this, there are always voices that say, "Well, let's block internet access in classrooms because it takes attention away from what I'm telling them," right? I won't go into that discussion now. But what we wanted to look at was the effect that computers that was on the net had on both the users in the classroom and the other students that don't use computers. How did they react to this? Was there any, were people distracted by this? Did they feel distracted? We didn't measure where they're distracted. We didn't measure the outcome of the studies. We didn't measure grading or anything like that. We were measuring how people perceived what was happening. So what we did was that after a number of lectures in different parts of the school, some nursing students, some informatics students, I don't remember what classes, there was someone on TEL here as well. We didn't inform people in beforehand, but after a lecture, we gave out a questionnaire to all the attending students in class. And they were to answer a slightly different questionnaire if they were using PCs or if they were if they were non-users of PCs in the classroom. So they were comparable, but there were slightly different questions. for instance, the non-users were asked, did you observe people using Facebook pages or something like that during the lecture? While the users were asked, did you do it? There was a total of 200 and something, 210 students. Out of them, more boys than girls. And a total of 8 lectures. And over all these lectures, we had 73 students that used PC and 137 that didn't. We did the same study in 2007 and 2011, so it was repeated at one time just to see changes over these years. Well, typically the questions had to do with what they observed and if they were disturbed by it and stuff like that. And we also had some descriptive questions. Why didn't, if you were a non-user, why didn't you use a PC? And then we divided the students, you could say we had, divided the activities that were observed or that they said they were doing into two groups. It was either what we called academic relevant activities done on the PC, taking notes, going to the web course web page, looking at the at front or the learning management system, for instance. We had a number of these activities that we thought of as obviously academic relevant. And we had some, you could say, irrelevant activities like news, general browsing, mail, YouTube, Facebook. Facebook was only in the 2011 study. And we want, of course, what we wanted to do then was to see was whether users and non-users of computers saw the world differently. Did they see the same usage pattern, and were they, for instance, more distracted by usage? Were there differences in how distracted they felt or how they reacted towards usage when we compared users and non-users? I'm focusing on this now because this is of course one of the variables, users, non-users. One interesting thing we saw, and this is the descriptive part of it, was that although all students now had access to computers in 2011, which was not the case in 2007, although this was the case, the number of users in the classes hadn't changed very much. There were typically some 30% that used PC. It's probably similar to what we see here now. A lot of you have closed them, but maybe that's just because we're talking about this now. I don't know. I can do it like this. So what we saw was that in 2007 there was a huge percentage that said that the reason they didn't use it was that they didn't have access to a PC. And that has completely vanished in 2011, and that's probably the case now as well. Well, a few don't have it, but most have access to a laptop or something they can carry, or they have a tablet, or they have a huge screen smartphone. But the number of users in class seemed quite consistent. So a lot of people choose not to use the PC in class. So it's an active choice of people, and most people uses this choice quite actively. So this was one of the findings we did here. So it's not a massive pressure from the students to be allowed to use PCs, actually. One interesting thing that we observed when we split the what they did into academic and non-academic usage, and we looked at what computer users reported versus what non-users reported. This is the relative amount of time used in academic and non-academic, on academic or non-academic activities. We saw that for the computer users, they reported a relatively huge part of their usage as academic relevant use. They said they were looking at relevant web pages, and they were looking at the learning management system, and they were taking notes, for instance. While when we look at the non-users, this picture has switched dramatically. The non-users reports the computer users to spend a lot more time on non-academic activities. So we saw an participant-observer effect here, which is a common thing to look for in a lot of psychological studies, for instance. Observers observe different things than people who are using something. So we don't know what's correct here, of course. We don't have the answer to this. What's correct? Did they spend time on relevant or irrelevant activities? Well, that's maybe not the interesting part either. The interesting part is that it's perceived by the non-users as irrelevant, and maybe then when it's irrelevant activities, as disturbing activities as well. It's more likely to be observed like that for observers than it is for users of computers in the class. When we say observer and user here, we are always talking about students. It's students in the class and in the same classes. And that can be compared to the next one here. If there were two questions that had to do with what are your attitudes towards computer usage in class? And these are combined data for computer users and non-users. We see that in general, on a statement saying that, well, computer use doesn't affect me, doesn't worry me a lot. There is a quite a huge, well, if you combine these two, there are some nearly 75-80% that say that, well, yeah, it really doesn't affect me much, it's okay. Some say they are disturbed by it. But what we see here is that we had another statement saying that entertainment use is disturbing. Well, most of them, 82%, say that yes, it is disturbing when people use PCs for entertainment. And this goes for both for computer users and non-users, actually. There were no differences if we looked at these two groups. Similar. So how do we conclude here? Well, we say that it seems like academic irrelevant use in the class is an attention grabber also for non-users. It tends to make people focus on what they're doing. I don't know why this is. It may be that the activities, well, what they're doing there are more interesting than a lecture. So that's why it catches attention, I don't know. But at least it seems to be an attention grabber. It goes for the classroom, but it probably also goes for other situations, is what we were discussing here. But what can we do with it? Well, in this discussion we say that, well, as it's become ubiquitous, as we say, it's there. We can't avoid it anymore. It's the fact of life. People are using PCs. So we can't forbid it. What should we do then? How should we make this situation better? Well, maybe we could just have some discussions in classes, for instance, about culture. How do we use PCs in classes? It's okay to use them, but use them with some consideration. Think about your neighbor or something like that. If you start looking at a video or playing a game, a lot of people will look at that game because they can see your screen. Even if you're not laughing out loud. So that was this paper. That's one of the papers you will see. And where you're going to identify the independent and dependent variables, where you will see whether you will figure out how the variables are operationalized. And you're going to discuss whether there should be more operationalization. Maybe we weren't very good at operationalizing things here. Operationalizing, a different, difficult word. And you should also say something about the measures that we used. Were they reliable? And are the conclusions valid? So that's what you're going to write in your paper. Both these short papers should be analyzed in this way. It's a pass, no pass thing, and it should be done, should be delivered, handed in before, or I've said the 3rd of September, 1 week from now. Should be doable. It's not a big task. Okay, back to, we have 15 minutes left here. Any questions about the assignment? It's a hand-in folder in Frontøy, so it should be handed in there. Not given to me personally or anything, but handed in there. Written in any language I can read. No pass thing, as I said. If you do it wrong, you will get another chance. So don't worry, just do it. Doing research is about taking control. What we want to see is whether there is a relationship between variables. We want to see whether a manipulation or something in a pure experimental way, for instance, this is a typically test-retest situation. You test something before you have introduced the change. Then you do the change, and then you measure something afterwards. This is a classic design. Typically, when you, for instance, are testing out a treatment or medicine or maybe a change in an organization or a new algorithm, it could be a new algorithm who does something, crunches some data. Well, you test something before you do this, and you test it afterwards. And what you want to do then is to establish some kind of a causality between what the manipulation you did and the changes from test 1 to test 2. So we want to say something about a cause and effect thing here. Something causes the next thing to happen. There are a number of threats to say something about causality, that something leads to another thing. History is one thing. Maybe something else happened in between that caused this change. Maturation, things do change. People get older from 1.1 to 0.2 if you going to test reading ability in children, and you test them if you test small children months apart, well, they have matured, they've become better. It's a natural effect, which makes it difficult to say something about a cause and effect relationship. Of course, you may have test effects. That's typically a thing when you measure psychological variables. It also goes for other situations. I was going to measure how many of you who were able to come up with the right question in Wason's reasoning task, which we used last time, which letters and which cards should you turn around to be able to confirm the statement. If I redid the same one now with some other names or other letters today, well, the result would be completely different. Of course, it would be a lot better because now you had... when we did this last time, you weren't aware of the rules involved here. And you weren't aware of the effects and the biases involved. The next time you test the same thing, you will be aware of that, and you will react differently. The same goes for a lot of these questions. If we repeat a measurement, well, the fact that you have done the same stuff earlier on is problematic. You may have changes in the instruments you use. Maybe they are changing. There's a number of these threats to causality. Let's just try an example of this history thing. We talked about... we had this problem statement that had to do with the effect of a campaign to reduce speeding. Let's say that we did that stuff. We measured mean speeds of cars on a given stretch between here and Lillehammer. And we found that in our study that after the manipulation and after the campaign, people were driving 5 kilometers an hour slower than they did before. And based on this, we're consultants here, we write a paper and say that yes, this campaign was a success. How certain can we be of this cause-effect relationship? Are there any threats to this that you can come up with, that you can see right away? Think? Huh? Yeah, maybe. Maybe there was a big death accident or something like that. a little accident a week before the second measurement or something. Maybe something like that had happened, yeah? Maybe we took this measurement in another part of the year. We did the first one on a beautiful summer day and the next one on a wet day in the autumn or something like that. Obviously we wouldn't do that, but that's an obvious threat if that wasn't controlled for. That would be an obvious threat to the conclusion or to the observed effect. It would say that there aren't any causal relationship between these two. Other possibilities? Amount of traffic, stuff like that, yes. How can we control for these things then? Well, when it comes to before after things, it's of course a number of factors you need to control for. And typically these, the things we have measured here now, said here now, is something then you should include in your protocol for measurements. You should make sure that the weather are similar, or at least you should measure the weather variables here. And make sure that conditions are comparable before and after. And you should make sure that these are things that you have control of, and control is the important thing here. You need to make sure that all the variables that's involved is something that's that you have control over. Another important thing here is that we tend to, even though we establish a relationship between variables, even though we see an effect here, there are a relationship between the manipulation we did and the measurement with the outcome on the other end. Well, just establishing this relationship is not enough, because there may be a lot of other things involved. And it's important to say that, to be aware of this. Correlation as such, that two things relate, is not the same as one leads to another. They may be completely unrelated, and there may be something else that is the reason for an effect that we see. These are just famous examples of this. There is in Australia, for instance, you can easily measure a really strong relationship between ice cream sales and shark attacks. Does that mean, or one conclusion there could of course be that sharks like ice, or likes people smelling of ice cream or something like that, which could be a conclusion. But what do you think is the situation here? Yeah, of course people swim when the weather is good, so there are more food available for the shark when the weather is good. Therefore more attacks. So there is a third variable involved, which is often the case, and which that this is something we want to correct for then by applying good experimental procedures. Another problem we have when it comes to causality or cause-effect relationships is what we call the direction problem of things. Could be the case, for instance, with meditation and good humans or something like that. We say that those who do a lot of meditation, they are better humans. But the other way could also be correct. There could be there is an alternative explanation here. For instance, people that are good, or that are thinking of others and that are empathic and stuff like that, they are more likely to meditate than those who are more egoistic or something like that. See that? There is, it's more or less up to you to say what direction this link has. And this has been the case, for instance, in the debate on whether there is a relationship or not between playing violent computer games, for instance, and being more aggressive or violent yourself. There is an established hypothesis saying that the more games you play, at least that's a common thing to think about, the more violent computer games you play, the more likely you are to be violent yourself. This is a huge debate. As you've seen it, and you may have your opinion on this as well. It was quite early established that yes, it is possible to measure such a relationship. The more, and this was done earlier, and this debate is old. It hadn't originally didn't have to do with computer games. It had to do with watching TV, children watching violence on TV. The same debate. And it was a famous American study that showed a very strong relationship between the time spent watching violent videos and how aggressive children were. Aggression then measured as by peers or other observers. And this was interpreted to be some kind of an evidence for a relationship between these two variables. Do you see any problems here? Anyone? Could it be the other way around? Because that was the first thing they did in this debate. Could it be the other way around? Could it be that people that were prone to be aggressive also tended to spend more time watching violence? Could it be that this relationship was the other way around, which of course would lead to completely different conclusions here? It could be. And it has been, of course, researched further. There isn't a very good conclusion on this now either. The general idea is that, yes, there is a slight relationship, but it seems to be like a vulnerability to it. People that are vulnerable to being aggressive, they may become more aggressive watching videos, whilst most people, for most children, it doesn't matter at all. That's the general idea. Well, I'm going to continue on this